This afternoon, as you can see by the title, we have Brother Len has chosen as a subject the Middle East mess. Very appropriate topic. Brother Len.
Thank you, Brother George, Bob. Thank you very much, Martha. It's nice to hear you play, and my sister, Virginia. Brethren, first, I would like to bring the love of our brethren in Delaware Valley. It's our class, and they voted to send love. It's very special for me to come back here because, as you know, this was our class for many years. When John showed you that picture of Gretchen and I on our wedding day earlier, he didn't say, because I don't think he knew, if that was in the house of Mary and Jean DeWeiss here in Grand Rapids where we got married. So that was 1972. So many, many precious memories. And very happy with you. Gretchen sends her special love. She and Rachel and Gretchen's youngest sister, Shannon, who you know just got back from a tour of Scotland and Ireland. It was Rachel's 40th birthday present. So she just got back Thursday, and I left Friday morning. So she said, please send my love. She's a little tired. So, but it is nice to be with you. She wanted very special love for the brethren here in Grand Rapids who are very, very dear to us. The Middle East mess. I almost call this Middle East mess number two because I had given this in New York. And it's been slightly revised, but I thought, had second thoughts about that title, that it might imply certain things that I didn't want to imply. So, but it is an apt description, and I'll tell you how this title came about. Former House Intelligence Committee Chairman Pete Hoekstra made a comment, this was back in probably about August. He said, we have a Middle East that is ablaze. We now have chaos throughout Libya, radical jihadists on the doorstep of getting into Western Europe. You've got a dead ambassador, American ambassador. You've got total chaos in Syria. Who knows what's going to happen in Jordan? Who knows what may happen in Turkey? And you've got chaos in Iraq. Wow, what a huge mess. Doesn't it give you a lot of confidence when a government official says this? So it's an apt description. This appeared, the Financial Times ran this piece, and I just wanted to show you the headline here, Short Guide to the Middle East, and I'll read you the words because you won't be able to read them, but I think it summarizes the everyday man's view of this. This is from K.N. El-Sabah. He says, sir, Iran is backing Assad. Gulf states are against Assad. Assad is against Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood and Obama are against General Sisi. But Gulf states are pro-Sisi, which means they are against Muslim Brotherhood. Iran is pro-Hamas, but Hamas is backing Muslim Brotherhood. Obama is backing Muslim Brotherhood, yet Hamas is against the U.S. Gulf states are pro-U.S., but Turkey is with Gulf states against Assad. Yet Turkey is pro-Muslim, Brotherhood against General Sisi. And General Sisi is being backed by the Gulf states. Welcome to the Middle East, and have a nice day. Oh, sometimes it seems like it's just utter chaos, isn't it? This is another person's attempt to sort of sort all this out, and you can see the lines going everywhere. Actually, the red arrows indicate enmity between the two groups of people, and the blue indicates support. Unfortunately, sometimes the blue and the red are going in the same direction. So again, sorting it all out is a mess, and it is a mess indeed. I'm going to leave this question with you for a minute, and then I'll come back to it later. Think about it. What looks odd on that map? Don't tell me yet, but take a look at it, and I'll come back and ask you that question again. Let's take a brief tour through the Middle East mess. In Jordan, let's start with those nations that are in the immediate Middle East. In Jordan, King Abdullah II is faced with an economy that is beset by all kinds of inefficiencies. They're lacking water, lacking oil, no other natural resources, and they're very dependent on Egypt to supply the energy. So naturally, they're going to be very cautious about what they say. But they have strong support and aid from the U.S., from the U.K., from France. Then there's Syria, Bashar Hafez al-Assad. 2 million refugees have come into his country from Iraq crossing the borders, let alone those that have gone out. Recently, we've heard the news about chemical weapons used on the rebels. I'll talk about that in a minute. But he's told the U.S. in no uncertain terms that if you invade us, expect another Vietnam. One of the interesting things in this whole conflict has been the resurgence of an old enemy, someone we thought was dead and gone, unless you were a student of prophecy. And then you realize the rise of Russia in this whole conflict is pretty significant. It's reintroduced this Cold War conflict between the U.S. and Russia. Now remember, just last month, the United Nations team, or actually earlier this month, I guess it was, the United Nations team in Damascus went in and found that, yes, we have found evidence of chemical weapons being used in this civil war. But, you know, it was one of these cases where both sides are pointing to each other, and it was inconclusive. They couldn't say, well, yes, it was here or there. So it's been an interesting dilemma for those deciding, what do we do about this use? You can kill people, 200,000 of them if you want, with conventional weapons, but boy, don't ever use chemical weapons because that really gets us mad. That's what it seems. It's sort of silly when you think about it, if you're killing people. But anyways, we'll talk about that more in a minute. Syria, meanwhile, is in very economic straits. Now, I'm focusing on a lot of economic issues here because I'm going to come later and talk about those specific issues being very significant in what we should expect happening for the future. The Syrian economy has had a devastating blow. Since 2011, when the civil war started, it's down 2% in 2011, when it was at the beginning of this revolution. Now, in 2012, down 31% and 7% so far in 2013. Can you imagine what that would do to an economy? Think about that. I mean, we've been faced with no growth, but certainly not the kind of declines that you see here. They had, prior to the revolution, 40% of their economy, of their economic growth, was generated by oil. Now, they are a net oil importer. You think Syria is in trouble? Yes. Perhaps you didn't know, but there was a thing called Operation Orchard. And I say, what if? What if Operation Orchard never happened? This is what Operation Orchard was. The CIA has confirmed that there was destruction of a nuclear reactor in Syria in 2007 by Israel. It was that reactor had been funded by North Korea, and the U.S. says at least three times Israel has struck inside Syria since that civil war began. Now, of course, Israel says, who, us? We wouldn't do something like that. They're not ones to talk about it, just take action. But it is significant. What if that hadn't happened and you had the ability not just for chemical warfare, but nuclear warfare? Let's go to Iraq. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Almost 2 million refugees, as I said, have crossed the Syrian and Jordan border from Iraq. They've got a fleeing of people away from that country. They haven't. Why? Because there's no resources to provide for them. The country is in an economic chaos. Very extremely difficult period. Saudi Arabia. The biggest of the lot, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. And incidentally, this is his real name. And Rick, I'm going to ask you to try to pronounce that, let alone the ones that were back in the Old Testament where you were reading. Anyways, King Abdullah says that he was a suspected power behind the Syrian rebels. He supports that current regime in Egypt, by the way, the one that is under attack. Saudi Arabia has a lot of problems themselves. They've been a real powerhouse in that Middle East, and many companies have taken real investments in Saudi Arabia. But the bad situation there is 50% of the population is under 25. And 30% of those in that 15 to 25 age range are unemployed. 30%. That's a big number of people with nothing to do except strap bombs to themselves and look at blowing up people. Lebanon, Michael Suleiman of Lebanon, has been the biggest outspoken critic of Israel while still opposing in his own country Hezbollah. And Hezbollah continues to threaten him with the overthrow. They're sort of mild at this point, but promise to be active in the future. The situation in Lebanon is very dire. Public debt is at 150% of gross domestic product. Remember, gross domestic product means products that are produced within the country. So it only includes those that are produced within the country, not from sources outside the country, plants or whatever. So 150%. Now, anyone that runs over 80% is in much difficulty. So there's a real issue in Lebanon. So each one of these countries is facing real dire economic circumstances. Then Iran, Hassan Rouhani of Iran. Recently some developments there that were interesting or significant. Mojtaba Ahmadi, who was the head of their cyber warfare program. Remember, cyber warfare is the computer attacks, and you read about those computer attacks all the time. On the 3rd of October, just last week, he was shot dead, found shot dead in the park. Before that, five nuclear scientists and the head of their ballistic missile program were killed. Now, he accuses Israel, U.S., and Britain. Israel will say very little, except we know they have the Mossad and the IDF that are very efficient in saying, we will not let Iran, we will not let them, we will not let Iraq threaten us. So it's an interesting situation because who wants to say what they have done? His economy is under an enormous pressure again. Why? Because of the sanctions that have been imposed there, financial restrictions that say you can't do business in Iran in dollars, in euros, or in British sterling. Now, that takes a lot of economic trade away. So Iran is under this enormous pressure, and what will happen, we don't know. In Egypt, of course, Mohamed Morsi was elected 2 years ago. July 3rd, his term ended. He refused to step down and recognize the election, so General Sisi led an uprising. Over 1,000 were killed, still going on. Now there's 13% unemployment there, very low growth. Tourism, those of you that have gone to the pyramids, gone to Egypt, you know tourism was a big part of their growth. That was 7% of their gross domestic product generated by tourism. That has dried up and gone away. And on just today's what, the 12th, 3 days ago, the U.S. cut their aid, made that decision to cut aid to Egypt because of what they called a military coup. And any military coups that are conducted, the U.S. will not fund that country. Now, that's caused some concern, and I'll talk about that on Israel's behalf. Let's talk about Israel, our focus on the Middle East, of course. A senior Syrian official on August 26 issued the first warning, as I mentioned before, that if they were attacked by the U.S., they would retaliate. But hey, we're not going to retaliate against the U.S. We're going after Israel. So, John, if you beat me up, I'm going to go beat Rick up. That's the kind of sense it makes, doesn't it? I love to pick on Rick. He's my buddy. But here's what they said. He said, the region will go up in flames. That will affect security not only in the region, but across the world. Within the last 2 weeks, let's revisit that, what happened actually. Because we all know that there was a threat to carry out this action against Syria. On August 30th, the U.S. phoned Israel And they said they were going to strike Syria within 48 hours, that surgical strike, remember, that they talked about, that would be a nothing in their mind, but just to let them know they were there. And remember John Kerry, Secretary of State, getting up that day, and he's giving a speech, which was really a preparation speech to let everybody know that this was going to happen. The very next day, remember, President Obama takes a walk with his chief of staff, Dennis McDonnell. And after that walk in the White House garden, he changes his mind. And he says, we're going to now go to Congress, and we want Congress to support it. So this was of some concern to Israel. Netanyahu, the very next day, delivered a speech to the UN. And I don't know if you heard that speech. If you haven't, it's worthwhile reading the text of that speech. Very powerful speech. And in that speech, he said, we will go it alone if we must, regarding Iran's nuclear buildup. And he expressed great concern over the fact that we had cut Egypt and reduced the aid, because Egypt has been Israel's real ally there. They've been negotiating the peace agreement that was made some years ago. So Israel's feeling more and more isolated, and the latest move by the U.S. to restrict itself on this attack against Syria has caused them great concern. Brethren, we know we have that scripture that says all her lovers will leave her. And you can see those kinds of things happening because of the difficulties that surround the situation. Here's an example of something that they were counting on to happen that didn't happen. So let's go back to this. What looks odd on this map to you? Anything? You see that little red dot? See that red? Not this red dot on the laser, but that little red right there in the middle? Amidst all the green. So this is Israel's position in the Arab Middle East. Now, if I'm an alien, well, some might say maybe you are an alien, I don't know. If I'm an alien and I come down to the world and I say, tell me what's going on in the world, and they say, well, everyone's fighting against Israel. And I look at this map and I say, what? What do they want out of that? That's the situation, brethren, that appears today. You think this is about land? It's not about land. Look at Israel compared to its neighbors on this chart. This is a projection from July of this year. Israel is now a little over 8 million in population. A square mile is of 8,000. The only place bigger or smaller in Lebanon is all those that surround it. So Israel, in terms of population, is minute. You know, it's insignificant. So again, this is not about the situation of people. Zechariah, book of Zechariah, we know contains a lot about the prophecies of Israel. I'm not going to get too deep into them, but I want to point out a few that are significant as it relates to the situation which I've described to you. Zechariah 10:6. This is from the Complete Jewish Bible, and I wanted the translation to get the flavor of the Hebrew, which this presents better. It says, I will strengthen the house of Yehuda. That's Judah that we would translate, and save the house of Joseph, you can guess, of Joseph. I will bring them back in my compassion for them. They will be as if I hadn't driven them out, for I am Adonai, their God, and I will answer them. And I want you to just focus on that. They will be as if I hadn't driven them out. Now, brethren, I know there are some that discount any promises left for Israel. I think Israel's been replaced by the church and those promises are gone. I would just ask you to revisit that if it's something you're wondering about, because as you see things transpiring, you can't help but say there is significance in our events of this day surrounding this country of Israel, especially when we look at the prophecies that deal with them. God says they are to be planted. They will be as if I hadn't driven them out. Well, since the mid-1990s, we've seen a steady stream of people going back to Israel. South African Jews, American Jews, French Jews. They've either made Aliyah, which is the Hebrew word for ascent, and that's the word you'll see when Israel talks about it. It means going back up. Or they purchased property. They purchased property in Israel. Many of the wealthy financial people, even in our own country, have purchased property in Israel for potential immigration in the future. Why? Because they recognize the world's rising anti-Semitism and what might happen. Now, we focus on how the global financial crisis affected us and what happened in 2008 in our country and since then. But do you know there was something significant that happened because of that relating to Israel? It's the highest immigration to Israel in 36 years of North American Jews. I think this is going to continue. And I think if you believe the time comes as we're as the plagues are coming upon the earth and the financial difficulties get worse, I think you continue to see the immigration come from the prosperous Western nations back to Israel, the last place where we have a significant Jewish population. Zechariah, again, says this in verse 10 of chapter 10. I will bring them back from the land of Egypt and gather them out of Asher. I will bring them into Gilead and Lebanon until, and that literally means and, there is no more room for them. Now, I also haven't got it in here for because of the scope and time, that there will be a war between Israel and the Arabs, and Israel will prevail and gain more land that will be accommodating for their people. Meanwhile, here's an interesting event that happened in Israel. On October 2nd, they had thousands gather. Some of you may have been at that museum, Binyan HaOmah, in Jerusalem, and there was a convention there, one state for one nation. Paul, were you guys there during that time? Were you there on October 2nd? Okay, so that was going on while you were there, urging the country to continue building in Judea and Samaria. Now, that the press loves to call that the West Bank disputed territory, but it's really Judea and Samaria, to house the new inhabitants. Ignore what's going on in the rest of the world. We need places for our people. And so that rally has gone on. As Netanyahu said, we will stand alone if we must. So Zechariah goes on in the 12th chapter, verses 2 and 3, and he says, Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. Well, I think it's sort of funny that they would be a cup of trembling when you think of that population, that size, but yet that's exactly what we see are coming. People, is it fear? Is it hate, perhaps? Is it jealousy? Who knows? But he says, In that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. Brother, it's a burdensome stone now, let alone what it will become in the future. The world doesn't, so much focus, the world doesn't know what to do about this. And there's continual conflict over this small little piece in the Middle East. In July, the European Union came out with their new budget, and they had budget guidelines on cooperation with the nation of Israel. Here's what they said. They said any grants that take place from the EU, any prizes, investments, projects that are to be done in Israel can only be used within what they call the sovereign Israeli territory, not in any of the territory they gained since 1967. And so in order to avoid misunderstandings, any future agreements must explicitly reflect those rules. Netanyahu, what is his reaction? You can't do that. No. What does Netanyahu do? He has now made a strategic decision. He's going to boost trade with Mexico, Chile, Colombia, Peru, all those that are politically friendly countries. And you know what? They're some of the fastest growing countries in the world. Increasing trade with Latin America while Europe goes down the tube and we must go it alone. Well, where do we go from here? Joel 3, 1 to 12, rather lengthy period. I'm only going to highlight a couple things in here. Joel 3 is a prophecy that tells us, it's a command to countries that says, and incidentally, I don't have it underlined, but notice the one phrase there. It says, let the weak say, I am strong. I think that's an apt description of what's going on with many of these Middle East countries today. They are very weak, but they're exerting their strength. But here it says, assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, gather yourselves together, come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. What we see going on around us is the preparation period for that final battle that will be oriented around Israel and Jerusalem. Ezekiel describes it in more terms, a long prophecy. It's the one that you know as Gog and Magog. I won't deal with that part of it, only briefly, but here's a significant part as it relates to our day. Ezekiel 38:8 indicates, I believe, a long period of preparation. King James calls it after many days. Rotherham says after many days. But the Septuagint version puts it this way. He shall be prepared after many days, and he shall come at the end of years. It's not a 2 or 3 month event. This situation to build up to that final battle goes on for years. And that's exactly what we've been seeing going on. Ezekiel describes this great confederacy of nations. And he does it in two groups. There's a warlike group and there's a merchant group. So two motives, likely military and commercial. Now, I don't know what the military motives would be for going after Israel. I think it's still yet to be revealed. But I do know what the commercial would be. And I want to try to help you understand what I think it will be. I got a spider on my screen. Didn't show up. I thought it was on the projector. You didn't see it. Ezekiel 38:13, this is again the complete Jewish version, says, Sheba, Dedan, and all the leading merchants of Tarshish will ask you, have you come to seize spoil? Have you assembled your hordes to loot, to carry off silver, gold, livestock, other wealth, to take much plunder? So there is a group that wants to do nothing but take the plunder out of Israel. So I want you to think about what plunder could they take? Well, the fighters, as I said, they have the fighters, I think, are the Eastern Bloc. That bloc, as you describe the people, and I have to give credit to, whenever I have questions about Ezekiel 38, I always call or email Jim Parkinson, because Jim and I have discussed this many times. And Jim, I think with some credence, offers this explanation. The fighters are the great Russians with Armenia, the Caucasian groups. Then you have Georgia, little cities, Black Africa, North Africa, the Germanic nations, the Turkic nations. Those are the ones described in Israel as the military group. Now, again, I said, I don't know at this point what that might be. But the spoilers are the interesting group that we can see today. Arabia, westernmost Europe, former colonies like America, Australia, New Zealand, Sheba and Dedan, Arabia is at the head of this. Those that immediately surround Israel are wanting to pull things out of there, as well as those that are the former colonies of Europe and the Americas. Think about in a global world we have of greed and economic chaos. One block will bide its time to get the assets out of Israel. But as I said, as an alien, what assets? It's a peanut country compared to most people. What assets? They got no oil. And that's a good thing now, because Moses did the right thing. He did make the right turn going out of Egypt, because it's good that they don't have that dependence on oil. Well, let's look at what those assets might be. Let's look for a minute at Middle East economics. And this is the Global Competitive Index report that's issued every year. It ranks the competitiveness of 144 different countries. And it looks at all things like health, education, innovation, technology. So it's really an in-breadth and in-depth report. This is the ranking that they show for those countries immediately around Israel, the same ones I showed you on the other chart. Now, look where Israel ranks out of 144 countries. They rank 26th out of 144 countries. The only ones better is Saudi Arabia. And I told you what's happening there. It's deteriorating fast. And yet the GDP, remember, gross domestic product, the goods and goods produced within the country, compared to the number of people, divided by the number of people, Israel is almost 32,000, higher than anybody else by far on that chart. That indicates a tremendous productivity. You think that that's not something their surrounding neighbors would like to have as their economies deteriorate and fall? I think it is. Here's the percentage of Israelis engaged in scientific and technological inquiry. It's the highest in the world, the amount that they spend on research and development in relation to their GDP. Highest in the world. Israel ranks fourth in the world in scientific activity, and that's measured by the scientific publications per million citizens. The percentage of scientific articles published worldwide is almost 10 times higher than the percentage of the world's population that it is. Israel has the highest number of scientists, technicians, engineers per capita in the world, 140 per 10,000. Now think about in terms of the United States has 85 per 10,000, Japan 83, significantly higher. So what is the spoil? Well, if you work for any company or run your own company, you know that intangibles, intellectual capital, is now recognized by most as the most important source. We are going away from a manufacturing process. The world is turning to technology and intellectual capital. At the corporate level, those investments in things like R&D, innovation, all the things I talked about in that global competitive index is considered the most important in determining performance of a company. Now, just recently, we had a publication, The Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations, at the macroeconomics, and macroeconomics means the economy as a whole. Micro, when you see that term microeconomics, it looks at the individual firms in the economy. But macro means the entire economy. New growth theories have been developed and proved to show that the same importance in the growth of a country is based on intellectual capital. Here's Israel's rank in intellectual capital according to that index. Notice they rank in growth of gross domestic product, they rank fifth. Competitiveness, 15, and this is again out of 144 countries. Then look at the list. Education as a percent, 1. Scientist and engineer availability, 1. Expenditures on research and development, 1. Venture capital available, 2. Pretty significant. Well, brethren, let's conclude. I think what we see, God promises that Israel will enter into the kingdom that will be governed by Christ as the earthly seed of Abraham. That's a promise he gave to Abraham, which he will not break. But first must come this final battle of Armageddon, described in Ezekiel 38. We had Revelation 16, the prophecies of Joel. And these things that we see today that are happening all around us, these events that we see in the Middle East are not happenstance. It's the setting up, I believe, of this end time scenario. But remember, I said it's many years. It's not overnight. So we say, well, what's different? Every time we think it's not different, something else explodes. So I expect this could go on for many more years before it's resolved. But remember that when it does happen, that kingdom, Christ's kingdom, will be the first real opportunity for Israel to bless all the people of the world. You know, they haven't been able to do that. They've been scattered all over the earth. For 3,000 years they've been scattered. But it's given them something, just like it has given you and I the fact that we are pulled, the church is pulled from all peoples in the world, given us the experiences necessary to fit us as the bride. So I think this 3,000 years of wandering, living in all the cultures, has given them the ability to understand almost every nation. You know, the Russian Jews started coming back after the fall of communism. Remember, Russia had no God. It was forbidden to have religion. They had to be first convinced and taught about God because they knew nothing about Him. That's the years of preparation that the Lord sees that we don't. Israel as a nation, it is true, first has to go through a testing to redeem their heart and to bring them back to God. If you heard Netanyahu's speech, he quoted Scripture and he quoted the promises. And I had another friend I rely on for some of the issues around Israel, Brother Ken Rawson. And I said, Ken, what did you think? Do you think he was sincere? He says, absolutely. Absolutely. He's been sending his own children to Hebrew school. Brethren, there's a religious fervor being developed there that is part of Israel's future redemption. And that part of the test that may come on them by the Western Bloc, this bloc I mentioned in Ezekiel 38, may be an attempt by those nations surrounding, as well as the Americas, where many of the Jews are fleeing now, to brain drain that country. When they get into trouble from everything around them or military admonitions against them, can't you hear the proclamation going from the U.S., from Europe? Come home. Come back. We have a place for you. It will be a severe test on Israel as to whether they have that faith necessary to bridge themselves into the kingdom. Everyone in that group, either military or economic, will eventually submit to Jehovah God. Zechariah tells us in the 14th chapter, the 16th verse, it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Brethren, nations won't cease to exist, but the structure of nations will be altered. And now those nations that are against them will go up now to worship God and to get to know Him. So, brethren, in all this turmoil and mess, let us pray for the peace of Jerusalem, because the peace of Jerusalem will mean the blessing of the entire world. Amen.